Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is David Blumenthal. Dr. Blumenthal is the president of the Commonwealth Fund, a New York City-based nonprofit engaged in independent research on health and social policy issues. He was previously a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and served as the national coordinator for health information technology. Among Dr. Blumenthal's many publications is the book Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. Dr. Blumenthal previously appeared on this program in 2015 to discuss the state of Obamacare. He's here with me again to discuss the success of Obamacare to date and to look into its future under the Trump administration. I should also note that we're speaking just before President Obama gives his farewell address and President-elect Trump holds his first press conference. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
The last time we spoke about Obamacare, we broke down our discussion into three domains: access to care or insurance coverage, the overall costs of the healthcare system, and then the quality of care. And I wanted to stick with those again and briefly revisit Obamacare's impact on each of them. First, how has Obamacare changed the proportion of citizens who are insured versus those who are uninsured or partially or unevenly insured?
Well, the record of Obamacare on coverage is unprecedented in our history. We now have the lowest level of uninsured citizens and residents that we have ever had in our history, about 8.9% by the latest federal statistics. And that is a lower level than we've had, as I said, any time, including since the passage of Medicare and Medicaid, which, of course, in 1965, served to ensure for the first time many of our elderly and poor Americans. So on coverage, it's been remarkable. And coverage is a great medicine. One thing that's not often said about insurance is that it is a public health intervention. People without insurance are more likely to die. That's been established by many, many studies. So giving people insurance is like giving them medicine. And in that sense, we've made a huge investment in public health recently since 2010.
And what about Obamacare's effect then on the overall costs of the health care system? The last time we spoke, you talked a little bit about bending the cost curve. What's been the record to date on that?
Well, to the surprise of many, costs have remained remarkably contained since the passage of this legislation, which, after all, enabled many new Americans to buy health care. And I still don't think we fully understand why that is. Some people think it's a residual of our deep financial crisis of 2008-2009. Some people feel it is the result of reforms made by the legislation, the Affordable Care Act. But what's indisputable is that rates of increase in healthcare costs have been lower than they have been in decades. For example, the average premium for a employed person getting insured through their workplace has been going up about 3.5% a year compared to 6, 7, 8% a year before the passage of the Affordable Care Act. Medicare, which is a constant concern for the federal government and for the American taxpayer, has actually seen no real increase in expenditures per person, per insured Medicare beneficiary, for several years, and lower than normal, lower than historical rates of increase. So on cost containment, this period of time has also been a pretty pronounced positive experience. Now, we've heard a lot about premiums going up rapidly as a consequence attributed to the Affordable Care Act. This is largely about a very small segment of the market, the individually insured person who gets insurance through the marketplaces that were created by the Affordable Care Act, the so-called ACA or Obamacare marketplaces. There have been double-digit increases in those insurance premiums as proposed by insurance companies. That is, insurance companies are offering insurance with double-digit increases. We just supported a study published this week in Health Affairs that showed that in California, where we have data on the difference between what insurers charge and what people actually pay, and the two are not the same, that those double-digit increases are not seen in actual insurance charges as people buy insurance, because what they do is, if their insurance premiums go up, they go find cheaper policies. Uh-huh. And the result is that the policies are about 10 to 15% cheaper than the offers by the insurance companies.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned before thinking about the insurance that's been provided through Obamacare as a public good. And I wanted to ask you, this is harder to measure, but do you have any sense of Obamacare's impact on the broader social costs that are associated with the absence of health care insurance? Because if health care insurance is translated into medicine, not having that can cost society in addition to those individuals in different ways.
Sure. Well, we know that people's perceived welfare has improved. So part of the Obamacare program has been an expansion of the Medicaid program in states that have agreed to expand it. And we have been tracking people's sense of well-being in states that have and have not expanded Medicaid. And what we find is that where people have newly accessed Medicaid, their self-perceived health status is better than in states where they haven't expanded Medicaid. Now, it so happens that your rating of your own health, good, very good, excellent, poor, is epidemiologically a very good predictor of your future health. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, it's hard to find a better one. People who rate their health poorly are much more likely to die in the near future than people who rate their health as good or very good or excellent. So that improvement in perceived health is a good public health measure of better health. We also know that people's ability to access health care nationally has improved. Fewer people report that they can't get health care they think they need because of the cost of care. And we know that medical debt load has declined. So all those are socially important factors: self-perceived well-being with respect to health, debt burden, cost of care, and of course also access to preventive services, which has increased considerably.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Dr. David Blumenthal, the president of the Commonwealth Fund in New York City. Well, to finish up on this review, let's look at the quality of care. What's been the impact of Obamacare there on the actual quality of care that's being delivered?
Well, if you include access as a measure of quality, because after all, no matter how good or bad care is, if you can't get it, it doesn't help you very much. But let's put access aside for a moment. There have been some very remarkable improvements in quality of care in the United States over the last 5 to 10 years. It's not always clear how much of those are attributable to the Affordable Care Act. So I'm less confident in making causal statements about the relationship between the Affordable Care Act and quality. I'm a physician. I practiced primary care for 35 years. I attended on the inpatient service of major teaching hospitals in the United States, especially in Boston. I saw lots of people die from infections that they acquired while they were under my care and the care of my colleagues when I was practicing. And one of the most remarkable things that has happened very quietly over the last 5 to 7 years is that the rate of those in-hospital infections has absolutely plummeted. And fewer people are dying from infections caused by the lines, the plastic lines that we insert in people's veins to give them medicines. They're so-called catheter-associated bloodstream infections. Fewer people are dying of post-operative wound infections. Fewer people are dying from the insertion of urinary catheters. And also, aside from infections, fewer people are dying from bed sores, from adverse drug events, and so on. This is very well documented by national studies. It coincides in time with the enactment of the Affordable Care Act. And the Affordable Care Act included a number of incentives for hospitals to reduce those infections. But there are other things going on, so I don't think you can interpret this as directly or definitively causal. Another thing that's happened that is, I think, quite clearly attributable to the Affordable Care Act is a reduction in Medicare patients' readmissions to hospitals within 30 days of discharge. So if you think that not getting readmission, not being forced to go back into the hospital within 30 days is good for you, and that seems pretty unarguable, then that is a positive result of the, again, the incentives built into the Affordable Care Act.
So you're painting overall, thinking about insurance and then the costs and now the quality, you're painting a pretty positive picture here for the nation. So the political question I have for you is, in light of that, why do you think there is this working majority now of our elected national representatives who seem ready to significantly dismantle this program?
I think that since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, some of the fundamental problems that afflict our healthcare system and that are very hard to improve are now attributed to the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act has made better a number of things that it was intended to address. But it wasn't intended to address everything that's wrong with our healthcare system, nor could it. So one of the things that's happening in the United States is that employers are passing more and more costs of care onto their employees. People are unhappy with the cost of care they have to bear themselves personally. And one reason they're bearing more costs is that the deductibles that they are charged by their employers, not by their employers, but by insurance companies as part of the insurance that their employers purchase, have gone up quite dramatically. So people are paying more for their care, even though their care is not going up in aggregate cost as much. They're just paying a larger proportion of it. The other thing that's happened is that their wages have not gone up as fast as their deductibles. So we all know that there's been wage stagnation since the Great Recession. We hear reports about how finally, in the last month or two or three, wage rates are beginning to increase at a couple of percent a year. Well, if your wages are stagnant, but healthcare costs are going up at historically low but greater rates, let's say 3 to 4% a year, and you're being asked to pay a larger proportion of those costs, your feeling, your direct experience, is that you're less and less protected against the cost of care. And that's what's happening. Employers are shifting costs. They're not increasing wages. And the result is people are feeling more costs. And the other thing they're feeling, by the way, is drug costs. So as deductibles go up, people are exposed to the cost of purchasing their medicines. And it's not lost on anybody recently that medication costs have gone through the roof. So things that people used to buy for dollars a dose are now tens or twenties dollars a dose. And especially people who need these very high-cost specialty drugs for rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis, they are really, really feeling the burden.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Dr. David Blumenthal, the president of the Commonwealth Fund, a nonprofit research organization dedicated to healthcare issues. So there are some, particularly despite the clear sense that there's going to be some significant rollback of this program, there are some particularly popular aspects of Obamacare that seem likely to be kept. Which ones in your mind would be the ones that you would most expect to be preserved largely as is?
Well, the Republican majority and the president-elect have spoken of their support for several aspects of the Affordable Care Act. One is the provision that requires insurance companies to cover the dependent children or the children of people insured on their policies up until the time those children are 26. That's proved very, very popular and has had a big impact on reducing uninsurance rates among young adults in the United States. The other very popular provision that Republicans and the president-elect have committed to retaining is the prohibition against insurance companies excluding people from coverage because they have pre-existing illnesses, and also limiting the amount of they'll pay for somebody over a lifetime when they get sick, and discharging them from coverage because they are sick. Mm. So those are called guaranteed issue, guaranteed renewability, and limits on lifetime benefits. So those are all things that the Republicans have said they support. So that has been a very important item of discussion as people have turned to thinking about how to fashion a replacement for the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, and there's been this discussion of a repeal, or a repeal of sorts, depending on who's framing this, along with then a delay in the implementation of that, and then a phase-in of that of some kind, and then that will be followed by the implementation of a replacement. Do you see any problems or challenges with that kind of segmented approach?
Well, first, let me say that we're recording this on a Tuesday morning,
right,
and that the strategy that will be pursued by Republicans in the Senate and the House is very much in flux. And there are divisions within the Republican Party, not to mention between Democrats and Republicans, about how to approach the pledge that Republicans made to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. So this is very fluid, and I have no idea by the time this airs what, in fact, will have developed. But as of now, the closest thing we have to an official statement of intent is that Republicans propose to repeal the Affordable Care Act, parts of the Affordable Care Act, which they can do through a procedural device called reconciliation, propose to repeal it, and then to replace it over 2 to 4 years. And they need to replace it for a number of reasons, partly to achieve the commitments that I just discussed that they have made to retain parts of it. Also because they have said that they don't want to take coverage away from any of the 20 to actually closer to 30 million people who are actually dependent on the Affordable Care Act for coverage or access to coverage. So they have a real challenge to find a solution that they can convince their members is consistent with the Republican Party's commitments and principles, and also meets those criteria. So it's not easy to do that. They weren't prepared to do it. I think everyone was surprised at the outcome of the election. They have bits and pieces of programs. They have actually some full legislative packages that have been proposed by certain members, but they don't have a consensus on what to do. And this is a new enterprise for our Republican colleagues. They are not typically in the position over history of proposing major new coverage legislation. Mm. But that is what they will be in the business of doing if they choose to replace the Affordable Care Act. They have certain ideological and political challenges in that regard, because to cover people who are poor and can't afford their coverage, you have to come up with money, and the money has to come from someplace. And generally, that means from taxes, from federal revenues. And that means increases in taxes or a diversion of money from other programs that have constituencies like Medicare and Medicaid. So this is unprecedented in the history of our insurance discussions that the Republicans would be taking the lead in a major new health reform activity, and they are apparently uncertain of how to proceed. And that's why they are waiting, saying it's going to take 2 to 4 years.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Dr. David Blumenthal, the president of the Commonwealth Fund. We've just got a couple minutes left, but I did want to ask you this question about Medicaid. You've mentioned it a couple times, and a key component of Obamacare's expansion of health insurance coverage was the expansion of the eligibility for Medicaid, and the Medicaid program is paid for by a mix of federal and state dollars, and here in New York State, some county dollars as well. But under the expansion, however, the additional costs are being almost completely borne by the national government. And as you pointed out earlier, not all the states have opted in to this program. My question is, in just a minute or two, how secure do you think that level of national funding for the expanded coverage through Medicaid is going forward?
I think it's in jeopardy. It's in jeopardy in two ways. First, the level of funding has been a topic of controversy, and a number of Republicans have suggested that we should walk back to the level of funding that existed before the Affordable Care Act was passed. There are also major proposed reforms to how Medicaid is implemented and managed and structured. So, so-called block grants, which would deliver to each state either a certain amount of money per state or a certain amount of money per person eligible for Medicaid in that state, and do that in advance at a fixed level, which would be different than has been true in the past. In the past, basically the state and the federal government paid whatever amount Medicaid beneficiaries incurred as expenses. Under a block grant or a per capita cap, that amount of money would be fixed in advance each year so that it could not exceed a certain amount. So those are the two proposed changes for Medicaid. This is all wrapped up in repeal and replace, and in the negotiations that will occur through repeal and replace, or repeal and delay and replace. So it's very hard to predict what will happen, but there's no question that these are of huge consequence to poor Americans of all races, ethnicities, and in every geographic location.
Well, we'll have to revisit this in 6 months to a year. That was Dr. David Blumenthal. David, thanks so much for talking with me.
You're very welcome. Pleasure.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.